Lord of hosts musters the host for battle. And I will punish the world for their evil and the wicked for their iniquity. And I will cause the arrogance of the proud to cease and will lay low the haughtiness of the terrible. Jeremiah 25, verses 32 to 33. If you think this is going to be some small-scale thing, merely concentrated in the Near East, you're mistaken. This is going to be worldwide, because remember that at the same time, the nations of the free world are trying to do battle on one side against the Russian communist and Chinese communist hordes. You will find guerrilla warfare going on in our own territory. Jeremiah 25, verses 32 to 33. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, Behold, evil shall go forth from nation to nation, and a great whirlwind shall be raised up from the coasts of the earth. And those slain by Yahweh shall be at that day from one end of the earth even unto the other end of the earth. God's taking a hand in this. Remember what he says in Ezekiel 38 and 39 about the weapons he will be using? Storm, earthquake, volcanic eruption, pestilence. All his weapons that are so immeasurably greater that they make our hydrogen bomb look puny. You find an interesting little sidelight in Zephaniah 1, verse 11. Howl, ye inhabitants of Maktesh. Maktesh was the commercial district of Jerusalem. Howl, ye inhabitants of Maktesh, for all the merchant people, your translation says, all the merchant people are cut down. All they that bear silver are cut off. Now in the Hebrew, the same word, Canaan, means a merchant, and it means a Canaanite. They've been, you notice, one and the same all these centuries. Then Jeremiah, the 25th chapter, which tells you how big a total plan this is. We're just seeing the final finish of it. For thus saith Yahweh God of Israel unto me, Take the wine cup of this fury at my hand, and cause all the nations to whom I send thee to drink it. And they shall drink and be moved and be mad because of the sword that I will send among them. Then I took the cup at Yahweh's hand and made all the nations to drink unto whom Yahweh had sent me, to wit, Jerusalem and the cities of Judah and the kings thereof, the princes thereof, to make them a desolation, an astonishment, a hissing, and a curse as it is this day. Now that was written looking to the future, because remember that Jeremiah wrote this before the Babylonian captivity. Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and his servants, and his princes, and all his people, and all the monarch people, and all the kings of the land of Uz, and all the kings of the land of the Philistines, and Ashkelon, and Asa, and Ekron, and the remnant of Ashdod, Edom, a pestilential lot then as they are today, and Moab and the children of Ammon, and all the kings of Tyre, and all the kings of Zidon, and the kings of the isles which are beyond the sea, Dedan and Temah and Buz, and all that are in the utmost corners, and all the kings of Arabia, and all the kings of the mongrel people that dwell in the desert, and all the kings of Zimri, and all the kings of Persia, and all the kings of the Medes. Now this was the early, ancient phase of this he's talking about. But remember now, he's just getting started on this. And all the kings of the north, far and near, one with another, and all the kingdoms of the world which are upon the face of the earth, and the king of Babylon shall drink after them. Now, of course, the fall of Babylon, the ancient city, was part of this process he's been talking about. And far from coming after all these others, it was simply intermingled with it. But you remember the Bible continues to talk about Great Babylon right down to our own day. And we are living under the domination of the old Babylonian system, economic, religious, and political. And you find it clear into the book of Revelation, 16th, 17th, and 18th chapters. So that's where the final smash-up is going to come. Therefore, thus shalt thou say unto them, thus saith Yahweh of hosts, the God of Israel, drink ye, and be drunken, and vomit, and fall, and rise no more, because of the sword which I will send among you. And it shall be, if they refuse to take the cup at thine hand to drink, then shalt thou say unto them, thus saith Yahweh of hosts, ye shall certainly drink. For lo, I begin to bring calamity on the city which is called by my name. And should ye be utterly unpunished, ye shall not be unpunished. For I will call for a sword upon all the inhabitants of the earth, saith Yahweh of hosts. This is going to be worldwide. Therefore prophesy thou against them all these words, and say unto them, Yahweh shall roar from on high, and utter his voice from his holy habitation. He shall mightily roar upon his habitation, and he shall give a shout as they that tread the grapes against all the inhabitants of the earth. A noise shall come even to the ends of the earth, for Yahweh hath a controversy with the nations. He will plead with all flesh. He will give them that are wicked to the sword, saith Yahweh. For thus saith Yahweh of hosts, behold, evil shall go forth from nation to nation, and a great whirlwind shall be raised up from the coasts of the earth, and those slain by Yahweh shall be at that day from one end of the earth even unto the other end of the earth. They shall not be lamented, neither be gathered or buried. They shall be dung upon the ground. So if you expect this to be a simple and pleasant little process, no. This is going to be rough when it comes. And you can see the first phases of it starting now. You can see the setup over there in Palestine. Our government committed to help Jews in their evil. Our government maneuvering to cause the Arabs to cut off the oil without which the free world can't be defended. The whole setup is rising before your eyes. Ezekiel 15, verses 6 to 8, has an interesting little thing about these Jews over there in Jerusalem. Therefore, thus saith Yahweh God, as the vine tree among the trees of the forest, which I have given to the fire for fuel, so will I give the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and I will set my face against them. They shall go out from one fire, and another fire shall devour them. And ye shall know that I am Yahweh when I set my face against them. And I will make the land desolate because, now note this reason, because they have committed a trespass, saith Yahweh God. Now, when you go on somebody else's land wrongfully, without permission or right, you are committing a what? A trespass. And that's what these Jews have done. They have committed a trespass in going into Palestine. Hosea 12, verse 7. And here again, it's one of these problems of translation, part of the 27,000 mistranslations in your King James Version. It says he is a merchant, but the word is Canaan, a Canaanite. He is a Canaanite. The balances of deceit are in his hand. He loveth to oppress. Well, who is it that are notorious for their desire to cheat you when they can by deceit, and for oppression whenever they gain power? Malachi 1, verses 1 to 4. I have loved you, saith Yahweh. Yet ye say, wherein hast thou loved us? Was not Esau Jacob's brother, saith Yahweh? Yet I loved Jacob, and I hated Esau. And remember, all these Edomite Jews are descendants of Esau. And in fact, by intermarriage, you can say most of them have some of this Esau-Edomite blood in them. Yet I love Jacob, and I hated Esau. Whereas Edom saith, we are impoverished, but we will return and build the desolate places. Hoy, they are impoverished. They didn't get to steal all the wealth of Germany. And how they are talking about how they are rebuilding the sites of some of the ancient cities in Palestine. You know what they're doing? You see that in the paper today. Thus saith Yahweh, they shall build, but I will throw down. And they shall call them the border of wickedness, and the people against whom Yahweh hath indignation forever. Forever is a long time. And God doesn't hold a grudge forever without good reason. If a rattlesnake bites me, and I say, well, I'm soft-hearted, I forgive him. After I have forgiven him, what is he? Isn't he still a rattlesnake? And won't he bite me again if I step close to him? And don't you ever think that God doesn't have brains enough to know that. He has indignation against these people forever for that very good reason. Then in 2 Esdras, you find a lot of interesting things in there. I'm very fond of reading that, even if it is left in the Apocrypha. Most of this consists of Esdras, who is the writer of your book of Ezra in the Bible, asking questions of God, trying to get information about these things, and in some cases getting it, in other cases being told, no, you have to wait and see what develops. And I answered and said, what will mark the parting of the times, or when will the end of the first or the beginning of the second be? The end of this age, that is, and the beginning of the new one to come. And he said to me, from Abraham to Abraham, for from him sprang Jacob and Esau. But Jacob's hand held Esau's heel from the beginning. For Esau is the end of this age, and Jacob is the beginning of the one that follows. For the beginning of a man is his hand, and the end of a man is his heel. Between the heel and the hand, look for nothing else. Now, this present age is certainly under the total domination of these Edomite Jews. And all the wickedness that marks it is the result of that domination. And nothing good can come until that domination is totally destroyed. So, Esau is the end of this age, and Jacob, Israel, the real Israel, the beginning of the next. Well, Bible history had a way of beginning most of it in and around Palestine. Some of it's going to end in and around Palestine. You can see the connection. You can see the whole plan working out now. Only willful blindness could keep anybody from seeing it now. The stage is set. The lines have been assigned to the players. And they're all ready to raise the curtain on the last act. And this is what I've been reading to you.
Thank you. My subject today is the summit or the pit. We are now being told to rejoice and expect good things because President Johnson has held a summit conference with Kosygin to negotiate for the accomplishment of evil. I say negotiate for the accomplishment of evil because nothing else can be negotiated with Kosygin. He will not agree to anything else. And so far, our leaders have always made it their most sacred principle to make some kind of an agreement, if it be possible, at any sacrifice of honor and justice. Do you wonder, therefore, that the results of these conferences over the last 30 years have been uniformly bad? It doesn't take a prophet to see the only possible result of such agreements. It is obvious to even the dullest mind. We never take a firm stand for the right and tell Russia she'd better retreat or else. No, we always back down and compromise with Russia for about half of what she demands, giving her always a victory without Russia having to fire a shot or take any risks. That is how communism has spread over half the world in the last 22 years. The Bible records the first summit conference, the one held by Satan with Adam and Eve. Originally, Satan held a position which might be described as that of governor of this planet. He was a very important angel, given great power, but power which must be exercised only in obedience to God. Then we rebelled against God and thereby forfeited all right to this power, and Adam was sent here to take his place. Adam was then an immortal being. Otherwise, the warning that death was the penalty for disobedience would mean nothing if he was going to die in any event. The Garden of God in Eden was not a plantation of ordinary trees and shrubs. The trees in it were the family trees of races and nations. In the 31st chapter of Ezekiel, God says, "The Assyrian was a cedar in Lebanon. His height was exalted above all the trees of the field. The cedars in the garden of God could not hide him. The fir trees were not like his boughs, and the chestnut trees were not like his branches, nor any tree in the garden of God was like unto him in his beauty. All the trees of Eden that were in the garden of God envied him." Now, you can't find any tree in a park or a forest that envies anybody. It just isn't that kind of a tree. Again, Adam was warned not to eat the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. No tree has knowledge or experience of good and evil except a family tree of people. God didn't create a special new being, Adam, just to spade up the ground. He already had millions of the pre-Adamic peoples for that purpose. Adam was put here to take the place of Satan and to govern the racial family trees of the world and rule them by the laws of God. But Adam, like ourselves, shrank from the unpleasant duty of throwing out wrongdoers by force. And before he got around to it, Satan had held a summit conference with Eve, who seems to have acted as Adam's State Department. Satan suggested that Eve give his plan a fair trial to see if it wasn't as good as he said, and this seemed reasonable to Eve. Adam decided that, after all, as long as they were talking, they weren't fighting, and that an agreement for peaceful coexistence arrived at by negotiation was better than war. So he went along with the plan, overlooking the obvious fact that no proposal from an evil source will ever be other than evil, that the wicked always negotiate for their own advantage and our loss, and that compromise with evil has never produced anything but more evil. Adam and Eve learned the hard way. Unfortunately, we never learn at all. The fourth chapter of Matthew and the fourth chapter of Luke record the next summit conference, this one between Satan and Jesus Christ. It reports that the devil, taking him up into a high mountain, showed unto him all the kingdoms of the world in a moment of time. And the devil said unto him, "All this power will I give thee in the glory of them, for that is delivered unto me, and to whomsoever I will I give it. If thou therefore wilt worship me, all shall be thine." In other words, if you will recognize my power and authority, I will recognize yours. Then we will peaceably coexist. This is exactly what Kosygin has already proposed and probably repeated to President Johnson. You recognize my rightful authority over all the enslaved nations of the world, and I will recognize you and NATO as rulers of the free world. But take careful note of this. Jesus Christ did not fall for it. He knew that the powers of evil are never sincere, will never keep their word. But even more important, he knew that good cannot derive its authority from evil. And whenever you concede the power of evil as being of lawful right, you give evil the victory. Jesus Christ was offered other opportunities to compromise with evil, to tone down his own preaching into something which wouldn't offend the ruling powers, and thus to avoid war with them. But not once did he ever yield to this temptation. He knew that his firm insistence upon truth and right was forcing the issue to a point that must lead them to murder him. But he also knew that abandoning the right and yielding a shameful victory to the powers of evil also led to death, but a death through which there would not be resurrection to glory. What can we expect to negotiate at any summit conference? Will it be the release of the enslaved nations of Europe from the communist yoke? No, for the Reds have never been willing to negotiate for this, and to our eternal shame, we have never asked it. Having betrayed all Eastern Europe to the Reds in a shamefully corrupt political deal for the liberal vote here at home, we have ever since been contented to keep this evil bargain, and have never insisted upon even talking about freedom for our brothers, much less ever doing anything about it. Now are you surprised that the enormous Škoda arms factories in Czechoslovakia, which we delivered intact into the hands of the Reds, have ever since been working 24 hours a day making arms to be used against us? How can you escape the consequences of evil without undoing the wrong which you have done? It is not merely that we have done a wrongful act in the past. Such wrongful actions create wrongful conditions which remain to plague us until we set them right. Like all burdensome debts, this one draws a heavy rate of interest and becomes harder and harder to pay as time goes on. No, the only thing which we can negotiate with Russia is some further triumph for the Reds, something which increases their strength and weakens us. The communist beachhead in Cuba, which our own State Department helped them to create, now threatens our Atlantic coast cities with atomic rockets. And we lack either the integrity or the courage to do anything about it. In order to appease the Reds in Cuba, which of our allies are we about to betray in our negotiations? Or will it be an agreement for general disarmament? That will be utter suicide for all the free world. Conferences with evil are never at the summit. They are always in the pit of hell. What does it matter whether we send the president or just one of his underlings if we are only going to negotiate the step-by-step surrender to evil? While we cringe abjectly before Castro, while he builds bomber airfields and rocket bases 90 miles off our eastern coast, what respect can we command from Russia? Until we have recovered our lost courage, our lost honor, there should be no conferences whatsoever. And when we are once again ready to speak with the authoritative voice of courage and of power to redeem our own hemisphere from the first beasthead of communism without first whimpering for anyone's permission to do so, then again I say there should be no conferences. We should take a firm stand for truth and right and honor and say, these are our terms. There is nothing to negotiate, for we will not take anything less. That is not a risk of war, but the only possible way to avoid it. Our present pose of weakness and retreat invites attack. If we took a firm stand and meant it, Russia would yield. Russia knows that we have power to so destroy her that she could never recover. The only summit is with Jesus Christ and his righteousness, not with Kosygin and his malice, cruelty, and treachery. Let's get out of the pit. Today I want to talk about a strange prophecy in the book of Daniel, which is being fulfilled in our day, destroying many by peace. We Americans are a peace-loving people. We don't envy our neighbors, their land, or their wealth. We make no wars of conquest. So we find it hard to believe that others would attack us. We become involved in defensive wars because we suffer so much wrong without resistance that our long patience is mistaken for cowardice. Our enemies, both in other lands and within our own nation, take advantage of this. They know that they can always lead us into traps by pretending that they want peace. Russia is hard up this old trick right now in the United Nations, vigorously helped by the so-called neutrals. How can there be neutrality between good and evil? Jesus Christ himself said that he that is not for me is against me. Most of our churches are to blame for our failure to recognize this devil's trap for what it is. For it's all clearly stated in the Bible.
Yes, the Bible. You know, that book they so seldom read to you in your church. As for the United Nations, that palace of strangers cursed by God, their talk of peace was exposed by the prophets 2,500 years ago. Psalm 28, verse 3 calls them the workers of iniquity, which speak peace to their neighbors, but mischief is in their hearts. Jeremiah 9, verse 6 says, their tongue is an arrow shot out. It speaks deceit. One speaks peaceably to his neighbor with his mouth, but in his heart he lies in ambush. We see this at every session. Cuba and Venezuela talking loudly of peace while they plot the invasion of Nicaragua. Nasser's Egypt plotting the murder of the kings of Jordan and Saudi Arabia. Panama organizing for the theft of the Panama Canal from us because we conspired with Egypt in the similar theft of the Suez Canal. And all over Africa, the Negroes planning wholesale murder of the whites who brought them the only civilization they ever knew. Isaiah 57, verses 20 and 21 saw this restless evil. The wicked are like the troubled sea when it cannot rest, whose waters cast up mire and dirt. There is no peace, says my God, to the wicked. In that parliament of evil, the United Nations, who exposes these plots? Who demands the liberation of East Europe? Who frankly calls a spade a spade? No one. Isaiah the 54th chapter tells it. None calls for justice, nor any pleads for truth. They trust in vanity and speak lies. The way of peace they know not, and there is no judgment in their goings. They have made them crooked paths. Whoever goes therein shall not know peace. Why haven't our churches taught us that peace comes only from God, not from Russia? The Bible told it from the beginning. Leviticus chapter 26, verses 3 and 6. If ye walk in my statutes and keep my commandments and do them, I will give peace in the land, and ye shall lie down, and none shall make you afraid. Psalm 119, verse 165. Great peace have they which love thy law, and nothing shall offend them. Isaiah 48, verse 18. Oh, that thou wouldst hearken to my commandments. Then had thy peace been as a river, and thy righteousness as the waves of the sea. But instead of God, our people worship Roosevelt and Johnson, Stevenson and Bridges, who tell us that the only way to peace is by surrender to Russia's demands, the devil's peace on the devil's own terms. Hungary and Tibet know what kind of peace that is. Yet many red clergymen and corrupted churches support this. But this also is in the Bible. The 8th chapter of Jeremiah says it. For everyone, from the least even unto the greatest, is given to covetousness. From the prophet even unto the priest, everyone deals falsely. For they have healed the hurt of the daughter of my people but slightly, saying, peace, peace, when there is no peace. Were they ashamed when they had committed abomination? Nay, they were not at all ashamed, neither could they blush. We looked for peace, but no good came, and for a time of health, and behold, trouble. Ezekiel 13, verses 8 to 10 says to these ministers, because you have spoken vanity and seen lies, therefore, behold, I am against you, says the Lord God, and my hand shall be upon the prophets that see vanity and the divine lies. They shall not be in the assembly of my people, neither shall they be written in the writing of the house of Israel, neither shall they enter into the land of Israel, and ye shall know that I am the Lord God. Because, even because they have deceived my people, saying peace, and there was no peace. No, there cannot be peace with evil. Jesus Christ warned us always to oppose and fight evil. In Matthew 10, verse 34, he said, think not that I am come to send peace on earth. I came not to send peace, but a sword. Because we turn our backs on God and walk blindly into the trap every time some obvious villain says peace, Daniel 8, verses 23 to 25 tells us, and in the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors are come to the full, a king of fierce countenance and understanding dark sentences shall stand up. Never before have transgressors so come to the full, and Khrushchev's scowling face and double talk fulfilled this to the letter. Daniel goes on, and his power shall be mighty, and he shall destroy wonderfully and shall prosper. Never in all history has a nation risen to such power and destroyed so many nations by infiltration, corruption, and treason. Always, you understand, delicately called liberalism. Remember Khrushchev, drunk with power, strutting boastfully in the United Nations, hammering on the desk with his shoe, and in the same breath talking peace and threatening destruction? Daniel goes on, "He shall magnify himself in his heart, and by peace shall destroy many." Weigh those words carefully. By peace shall destroy many. By the infamous Peace of Potsdam, Russia was allowed to swallow all Eastern Europe and North Korea. Because we preferred Satan's peace to that of God, they were given China, Afghanistan, Tibet, Iraq, and now Cuba. And now our politicians want to talk disarmament with Russia, knowing that Russia has never kept its word in anything. About the time Roosevelt came to power here, Dmitry Manuilsky said in Moscow, "War to the hilt between communism and capitalism is inevitable. Today, of course, we are not strong enough to attack. Our time will come in 20 or 30 years. To win, we shall need the element of surprise. So we shall begin by launching the most spectacular peace movement on record. There will be electrifying overtures and unheard-of concessions. The capitalist countries, stupid and decadent, will rejoice to cooperate in their own destruction. They will leap at another chance to be friends with us. As soon as their guard is down, we shall smash them with our clenched fist. Today, this time has come. Everyone knows that communists never keep their word in anything, that they want us to disarm while they keep their secret stores of weapons, rockets, and nuclear bombs to attack us with. Yet our political leaders still propose to go through with this traitorous treachery. What is the reward for this folly? Isaiah 33, verse 7 tells us, "Behold, their valiant ones cry without. The ambassadors of peace shall weep bitterly. The highways lie waste. The wayfaring man ceases. He has broken the covenant. He has despised the cities. He regards no man." In other words, devastation will come upon us from Russia's treacherous nuclear bomb attack, which she will not fear to make after we have largely disarmed. Our military men are aghast at the treason and its consequences. Our diplomats wring their hands in hypocritical pretense of horror at the natural and inevitable fruit of their own connivance with evil. They try to appear shocked that the obvious result of their folly has come upon us. Yet what reason is there for surprise? Our attempt to make the devil's peace couldn't possibly have any other result. Don't you read in the newspapers and don't you hear people say, "We must keep on negotiating with Russia. As long as they are talking, they aren't fighting." People say, "Let's make an agreement with Russia so we won't have war." But making an agreement with Russia is exactly what will bring on war. God himself warns us of that. When we make a treaty with Russia for disarmament, millions of thoughtless fools will say, "Now we're safe, there won't be war." But war will follow swiftly after that. The Apostle Paul tells us in 1 Thessalonians 5, verse 3, "For when they shall say peace and safety, then sudden destruction comes upon them as travail upon a woman with child, and they shall not escape." The principle is old. Satan must always start with the thin end of the wedge. Evil can't be presented first in all its naked ugliness, but must first be disguised as good. Even then, those who read God's warning are not deceived. But the fools who put expediency above right, who will abandon principle to get the support of minority groups, who put political party above God, they will this time pay the penalty of death. By peace he shall destroy many. Will you be among them? You've been warned.